We're good?
Okay.
Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. Representative Peterson moves approval of the February 28th minutes. Any corrections, changes, additions, or stuff you want to make different? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendments are adopted. That's what I just did. Representative Ward moves approval of the minutes from the March 1st meeting. Any discussion, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two items on our agenda today. The first item is the Early Learning Task Force report, so I'd invite those testifiers to please come down to the table. And members, we're going to be hearing on the Early Learning Task Force report for roughly 45 minutes. And then House File 355 by Representative Kiffmeyer, we will start promptly at 1:15 in the afternoon. So I would ask those members, people who are testifying, to please be respectful of other testifiers, as we will be completing testimony on this report at exactly 1:15. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Karen Cadigan from the University of Minnesota. I work at the policy director at the Children, Youth, and Family Consortium, which is part of Minnesota's Extension Service. We are an intermediary organization that connects communities to research and communities to each other in order to improve outcomes for kids and families. And we were contracted to do the study on whether and how Minnesota should have an Office of Early Learning. Several colleagues helped significantly with the study, in addition to the task force members themselves. One is Nara Topp, who's an in-town consultant here, who might actually be here today. And the other is Stephanie Clothier from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Because this is an important issue, we enlisted the help of NCSL. And Steph could not make it today from her office in Denver, but she's happy to talk by phone with anyone, and also possibly could come to town if anyone wants to have more dialogue with her on this issue. So the most important thing probably to know about the Office of Early Learning Task Force recommendation is that it has nothing to do with four walls and a door. And I'll say a little bit more about that, but wanted to make sure that as you're hearing about this issue, that you really think about it as a governance reform issue more than a physical place issue. The task force came to be at the call of a piece of legislation. The task force was made up of roughly a third community members, a third agency people, and a third legislators. The task force built on the work of the Early Childhood Advisory Council's Accountability and Finance Committee and had as our goal the goal that the legislature has charged the state with, which is to have all children ready for school by 2020. So the work that we did really focused on that goal. The process of making the recommendation then included three things. One was some task force discussions and meetings. Second was gathering information. And third was public comment. An important point about the process of this task force is that all of the work happened between October 15th and January 15th. And we had tremendous engagement and attendance by our task force members. Sometimes, you know, these things happen and not everyone shows up, not everyone shares their opinion, not everyone talks. That was not the case. This was a very engaged and thoughtful group of people that had some difficult conversations and really thought carefully about what would be the best thing for Minnesota. So as part of the task force discussion, we really focused primarily to start out with, sort of to vet other decisions, with what would this thing do? What would be the functional priorities of such an office or such a new governance structure? And thinking that focusing on what needs to be done could help help sort of get us there, help move the needle in Minnesota on school readiness. And so some of the functional priorities that were developed are having a seamless delivery system, coordinating resources, and ensuring accountability for programs, establishing an administrative framework, and developing a data collection system. Our current system as you probably know, is spread through three, at least, some think four agencies, a bit of a, excuse me, with each with their own commissioner and own culture and own goals. And though this group of people is working together, is trying to work together, there are some challenges to having three different sets of silos. I was this morning at the Minnesota Chamber meeting and talking with some of the business leaders about this exact slide, and people were surprised, just sort of from an efficiency standpoint, that one would have three different sets of people sort of in charge of the same kind of outcomes. So the scope, one of the big questions about this proposed governance change is what would it include. You'll see on this slide the scope of what is suggested to include, and it does include programs and funding streams from each of the three agencies. And there, I should say, there's a lovely and quite detailed study done last year by the Departments of Education and Human Services called the MOVE study that talks about how one might actually join together this set of programs and funding streams. So another piece of our information gathering then was what happens in other states? How do other states attend to public issues related to early childhood care and education? And what we learned in sum up is that if you've seen one office of early learning, you've seen one office of early learning. That they all look pretty different, and some of them actually don't do, if you think back to the functions, like what would you actually want a governance and management structure to do, some of them don't do that at all. Others are called something other than an office, and they are able to make tremendous progress. Some of the examples of that I just wanted to mention quickly, though, are Florida. I know that y'all heard a little bit about Florida's education model yesterday or sometime earlier this week, Monday. Thank you.
And you just said y'all. I heard that.
And Florida has what they call an Office of Early Learning. It's actually housed in their workforce development area, and it's a lead agency, but there are other agencies involved, so it's not really coordinated in the same way that other places are. On the other far end, then, is the state of Washington, which does have an Office of Early Learning, and it is a lovely example of a public-private partnership. The foundation community in the state of Washington actually has given significant amounts of money, over $1 million, to help support that agency's work. The two that we looked at quite a lot are Pennsylvania and Maryland. And let me just take a minute to say something about Maryland, because it's a place that is not unlike Minnesota in terms of some of its outcomes and inputs and challenges. So Minnesota, as you know, uses the school readiness assessment, and our numbers on that school readiness assessment have essentially not changed in the last 8 or 9 years. Around half of our kids are fully prepared for kindergarten. Maryland uses that exact same measurement tool, and since about 2002, 2003, they have been seeing an increased uptick in the number of kids that are school ready. In 2005, they established this more streamlined and accountable office that oversees what they call their model for school readiness improvement. And as of their last report, fully 70% of Maryland's kids are school ready. So they made significant progress, even in groups, you know, of children that that would be considered at risk for poor learning outcomes. So what we learned from other states are sort of that context matters a lot. These kinds of changes have been made under Republican governors, under Democrat governors, with the support of legislature, without the support of legislature, sort of in all kinds of contexts. The third part of our coming to a decision was public comment. And this, I would say, is really one of the, not that working with the task force wasn't delightful, but public comment is always just fantastic to get out and talk to regular citizens. So we drove around a bit to Virginia, Fergus Falls, Bloomington, and Windham, and then we had an online survey that had about 600 respondents. And in general, I would say that there are some important perceived benefits by the public, both from comment and from the survey, from public in face-to-face comment and from the survey. Improved coordination, better accountability, streamlined requirements and expectations. Concerns were around really sort of what's in and what's out, what would be in and out of the scope of this issue, and then issues about the money. So how would a freestanding office, for example, be funded? Where would that money come from? Would it take money away from kids and families? What we did not hear, what we never heard, was that the current system, such as it is working great. Thanks. Please don't change a thing. We had a lot of creative ideas from providers, parents, and sort of regular citizens that are interested in little kids. As part of the survey, I thought, I'm an academic, so I sometimes collect too much data, but as part of the survey, we asked people what they think the state's current priority for young children is, and this is one piece of data that we thought was interesting, that fully a third of the 600 and some folks don't see any priority for the way we attend to the needs of young children in the state. So the recommendation then, the essence of the recommendation is one of the things I want you to take away from this, and that is to put someone in charge of early childhood existing programs, funding streams, goals, and someone who can identify and move barriers on reaching goals. The task force decided that the most sort of stringent level, the most formal level of accountability and responsibility would be the ideal recommendation. That is for a separate office of early learning. You might think of it a little bit like an office of higher education. So it would be a set of programs that is joined together with the singular mission, singular vision, singular person responsible. The last thing I wanted to say before opening it up for questions, I'm not sure when you want to do that, but is that there's this sort of lore in our field in education, in early education especially, that state agency leaders and staff don't get along well together. And we absolutely found that to not be the case for this. There was never a single incident of someone saying, oh, I don't want to move that away from my agency, or oh, you can't take this funding stream. And in fact, one of the most tremendous conversations we had was a meeting with it was 13 staff from each of the three agencies, all of them overseeing some part of early learning programs and funding. And they had not necessarily all been in the same room together to have a conversation. So it was really, it speaks to the need for having someone that has the sort of authority and is charged with calling that kind of coordination and conversation.
Did that complete your testimony?
That's it.
All right. I think what we're going to do is we're going to allow everyone to make their presentations, and then we'll save the questions for the end, if that's okay.
That's right. So actually, this is related but not directly related.
Sure.
I wanted to take a moment to just mention that the Science Museum of Minnesota just opened an exhibit on early childhood development, and we, the University of Minnesota, has been working with them on that as well, and happy to talk about that at another time.
Good.
Thanks, sir.
Yep. I should say I love the Science Museum and the Children's Museum, so lots of memories. Okay, who is our next testifier? Please come forward. And thank you very much for your testimony today. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Mayette, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation. And I'm also here representing the School Readiness Funders Coalition, which helped to fund the report that you heard here. Before I start my testimony, I just want to let you know that we have a packet of information about this that will be coming around to all of you, and it includes the complete report. So if you haven't had a chance to read the report about the Office of Early Learning, here it is for your enjoyment. Just to let you know about our foundation, we're a small faith-based foundation that funds children's issues in Minnesota, including early childhood education. And we joined forces several years ago with other funders of early childhood programs when we became a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition. And our coalition joins with you, the Minnesota Legislature, in the goal of seeing all Minnesota children ready to start school by 2020, that goal that Karen referred to. We recognize and support the fact that parents are the primary teachers and educators for their young children, and we believe, yes.
I was just going to say that you must have been storing these reports in your car there.
A little chilly.
A little bit cold here. So.
Well, they could cool your hands off.
Yeah, actually, it works out kind of nicely. It feels good.
My apologies. Well, I think there's a lot of good information in there.
My apologies. Please proceed.
No problem. But anyway, as I was saying that... believe that parents are the primary teachers and educators for their young children, and we think Minnesota parents deserve the strongest and most coordinated network possible to support them in this vital role that they play. We think the critical components to make all of this happen are leadership, accountability, and responsibility. And we really feel a key element of leadership is the position within our state's government that brings together and coordinates the currently fragmented programs serving young children that you have been hearing about. Our coalition is so committed to this task that we committed the funding to support the task force on an Office of Early Learning that Karen's been telling you about. I volunteered to represent the coalition on the task force this fall. And it was a really great experience to learn how this role's made a difference in for children and families in the various states where it's been established. Karen made reference to a number of states that have this kind of position, and it's really, really been crucial to get outcomes for children. It was also a revelation to see how interested the various representatives from the three state agencies that contain most of the childhood programs are to working together. Again, it's something Karen said, but I can't repeat it too much. It's just how impressed I was at the level of enthusiasm for finding some way of coordinating services. We've seen the goodwill on behalf of early childhood both in the public sector and also within private philanthropy and business, and we believe that bringing together early childhood programs in this state with strong leadership will help to move this goodwill towards results for children and provide the platform for true public-private partnership. It's essential to have some sort of a place within state government for public-private partnership to link. Minnesota's future depends on a great start for all of its children, and we really think this is the way to go. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And before our next testifier comes up, I just want to share a little inside joke with members here. One of the staff members to my left just leaned over to me and wondered who the guest was at the table over here and was wondering if they're allowed to sit at the table or not. And I had to inform the staff that's Representative Slawick, and yes, we...
who was a member of the task force and worked hard on behalf
of them. I'll let you figure out which one of these two did it. Maybe it was Miss Johnson. No, you're leaving. So, Representative Slawick, it's good to see you. You're more than welcome to stay, though. You do not need to...
I'd like also to all your members get here, I guess.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, and again, we're going to hold questions until everyone has a chance to present their testimony. So the next testifier could come forward. And again, just a reminder that we will be completing the presentation at exactly 1:15. And I would like the opportunity for members of the committee to be able to ask some questions if they'd like. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Sheila Carrington. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm a program officer at the Women's Foundation in Minnesota, and the foundation is a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition. The Women's Foundation is dedicated to growing equality for women and girls in the state of Minnesota. Over our 28-year history, the Women's Foundation has granted more than $12 million to fund and build the capacity of hundreds of innovative social change programs across the state. We also conduct valuable research on the status of women and girls in Minnesota to inform our grant making, educate opinion shapers and policymakers, and raise public awareness. Our goal is to build stronger communities and a stronger Minnesota. Economic justice is one of the five cornerstone areas funded by the Women's Foundation. The outcome for our economic justice cornerstone is creation of a future where women thrive economically and communities benefit when women, as a result of education, employment opportunities, and economic development, make poverty history. Our work in economic justice includes grant making and research. In partnership with the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the University of Minnesota's Center on Women and Public Policy, we have conducted research on the status of women and girls across the state. On a statewide listening tour in support of this research in the summer of 2008, the Women's Foundation held presentations and focus groups in 18 diverse communities, including 12 in greater Minnesota. As cited on the Road to Equality, our December 2008 report of focus group findings, in every group, whether urban or in greater Minnesota, access to quality child care was identified as the number one barrier to economic well-being for women. Overwhelmingly, focus group participants cited a, and I quote, broken child care system as a deterrent for women securing and holding a job, continuing their education, and assuring their children's readiness for school. The recommendation of the study was to fix the broken child care system. Our latest research on the status of women and girls in the state, released in June 2010, revealed three important points. One, Minnesota has the highest workforce participation rates for women in the country. Two, across all ethnic and racial categories, the majority of Minnesota women with at least one child in the home work full-time. And three, Minnesota has the third highest ratio of accredited child care costs to median income in the country, in some cases costing 50% of the household's income. As a result of these research findings, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota has chosen to invest our resources to help increase access to child care for women statewide, which includes our participation in the School Readiness Funders Coalition, as well as grant making to affect public policy changes that positively impact women's access to child care. For the reasons I've stated, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota fully endorses support of the task force recommendation to create a state cabinet level position tasked with funding oversight, rulemaking authority, and coordination responsibilities for all state early childhood programs. As a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota joins the Office of Early Learning Task Force in calling for increased responsibility, accountability, and coordination of early childhood education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next testifier, please come forward. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we know who you are.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jan Reindel, and I'm the director of the Investorly Project. And this is Sue Heft, and she's the committee director in Itasca County and also a member of our leadership team. We're here to talk today about our project and testimony for the Office of Early Learning. I'd like to give you just first quick a brief overview of our project, since many of you may not be familiar of what's happening in Itasca County. Our project is currently in its sixth year of operation, but it's important to note that the groundwork started 14 years ago when the Blandin Foundation decided to spend more of its resources on education. After many discussions and looking at research, in 2002, a task force was called together to look at gaps in early care and education, and this task force included members of Head Start, the four Itasca County school districts, public health, private child care, and the Itasca Community College. This group became the Investorly leadership team, and our mission is to deliver comprehensive wraparound services to children and their families while evaluating the long-term impact of the investment. We currently serve 330 children across the county. We've brought packets of information so that you can look through it, and there's an overview in there, and there'll also be documents that Sue will reference in her testimony. I'd like to just take 3 minutes and give you a success story, and I could talk about a 17-year-old mom that we had enrolled her child in our infant toddler program who was not only able to stay in school because we were there as a support for her, but was also valedictorian of her class last year. Or I could talk about a Grand Rapids father who thought that adult basic ed was really only for someone who needed a diploma. And instead, when he found out that it could help him with his resume writing and his job searching skills, he made appointments, came, and he was able to secure employment with the mines in Virginia. But who I'd like to talk about is Dylan. And he's a 3.5-year-old who was referred to me through his early childhood screening and came in with some, they came in with some needs, behavioral needs. And when his mother came in, she filled out the application and was over income for our Head Start funding, was over income for our Invest Early funding, but with our school readiness funding, we were able to say, okay, we can serve this kid. And he had recently been, expelled from a community preschool because of his behavior. And I think for the first 2 weeks that he was in class, the mother, you know, we'd say, well, he had a tough day today, and we're working on some things. We're working on some behavior plans for him. And the mother kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. I mean, you know, can he come back tomorrow? You know, she had been taking off work to care for him. The grandmas were trying to pitch in. Everybody was trying to. And because we have children's mental health as part of our project, a consultant, we were able to get him into a social skills group. And this last week, as I watched him come down for his group, he was sitting with three of his friends, and I listened to him as he waited his turn, and he responded, and he listened to his friends, and for 10 minutes he was engaged in this activity, and I thought therein lies our success, that we were able to not make mom go here, go there, go everywhere, that she could come to one place and find the services that she needed. And Dylan next year will be a 4-year-old in our program, and he'll be successful there. And it's not to say that it's the magic bullet that, oh, okay, all these problems will go away. It won't. But at least we're giving him some skills to build on.
So what we're here to talk to you today about is what we've learned in the process of changing our early childhood system in Itasca County. Jan mentioned 14 years, at least, we've been working on this process. And we want to link that to how the proposed Office of Early Learning would support our efforts on the ground locally in Itasca County. Early in our project, we really realized that our system of early care and education in Itasca County was fragmented and difficult for families to navigate. Parents had to complete an application at many different programs, oftentimes miles apart, filling out the same information on those forms. Our objectives were all the same. We wanted to enroll young children in high-quality early childhood programs and support families. Yet, we all went about collecting the information and enrolling children in different ways. The end result was duplication of effort on the parents' part, on staff as well, and many times, children not receiving the services because a parent filled out an application for a program they were ineligible for and may not have known about another program in the community. We've had examples over the years when we started of a parent filling out a Head Start application and not being income eligible, not realizing there was a school readiness process that they could be enrolled in, and they were maybe $100 over income for Head Start. Our early childhood leadership team worked together to identify common data elements that all the funding streams were required to collect, eliminated the information that was not essential to the enrollment process, and came up with a one-page common application that's used for all of our early childhood programs in Itasca County. And there's a copy of that in the packet that you'll be receiving at the end of our presentation. The application is processed by a small team that ranks and prioritizes children for enrollment based upon the agreed-upon risk factors and income ranking system that we have in place in Itasca County. Head Start funds are used to pay for the slots for the lowest income students. School readiness dollars pay for the next level of students enrolled in the program. And the Blandin Foundation, thankfully we have them in our community, invest their invest early dollars to support the students that were unable to pay for using the other two funding streams. Even with this blending of resources, we are unable to serve 100% of the eligible students in Itasca County, and we have waiting lists in each of our communities. Because of our coordination and collaboration behind the scenes, our effort, our work to come together, families have one application process that is streamlined and user-friendly. This is just a small example from the local level. If you scale that up and look at it, the state level perspective, right now, as programs, we fill out school readiness and Head Start plans, annual reports, and we provide demographic information to the Minnesota Department of Education. We complete child care licensing applications, pay fees, and are monitored by the Department of Human Service. And then we complete child and adult care food program applications and are monitored through the Department of Health for the food that we serve our children. Those are just at the state level, the different departments that we need to coordinate with. That's not even mentioning the federal requirements for the Head Start reporting. Imagine, if you will, one office of early learning and a plan that would satisfy all the requirements for DHS, MDE, and MDH. One plan that our community could put together and would be approved by all of those departments. One system of monitoring and evaluation that's required of all programs. Local programs would need to coordinate and work together in order to complete the program plan, prepare for monitoring and evaluation. The data collected would be integrated, and it would give us a true picture of early childhood in Minnesota. If our goal is to have all of Minnesota children ready for kindergarten by 2020, we must pull together and maximize our resources. In order to do this, we need to understand each other and build a common language, goals, and indicators of success. An example from the local level is that in Itasca County, we have been fortunate to have the Blandon Foundation support our leadership team project evaluation work with Wilder Research Center. The process we used required that we understand the mission of each early childhood program and their funding stream in order to set goals, develop programmatic strategies, and jointly train our staff. We train all of our early childhood staff together. We are all invested in the same evaluation plan and the same common goals that we've set. We celebrate our successes together and strategize solutions when we don't have the results we had hoped for. We are making progress on closing the achievement gap before the children enter school. There's in the packet, you'll also have a year four evaluation summary from Wilder Research, and then our draft of some of our evaluation pieces for year 7 and 8 of our project. There's a need for each funding stream and the expertise each program brings to the table. As we set our common goals, we realized how our differences added to the strength of the programming we provide for families. What may look like a maze of early childhood programs on paper became not unlike a patchwork quilt when woven together with the purpose of wrapping around and supporting our youngest, most vulnerable children and families. If we were to lose one of those funding streams or programs today from, say, reductions in Head Start funding or elimination of school readiness, it would leave a void for children and families, because in Itasca County, there's no duplication of service. Any reduction in those funding streams leaves a void for our kids. If you project the same concept from the local to the state level, you can envision a similar situation. Imagine if all the resources, talent, and commitment from the three agencies were truly focused on the goal of having Minnesota's young children ready for school by 2020. When an innovative leadership structure is formed, as the task force report suggests, and you include representatives from all the programs that support young children, put a plan for accountability in place, then you will see progress toward the goal of having all children ready for kindergarten by 2020. We are here to ask that you give serious consideration to the recommendations in this report, and that you realize the strengths inherent in all of our early childhood programs and funding streams as you make decisions regarding governing structure and funding for our Minnesota's family and young children. Thank you.
Thank you both. Just a quick question before you go. How far did you guys drive today to come down here and testify?
Actually, we came down last night late, about 3.5 hours.
Okay, so at least you got the overnight then. Hopefully you had a
yes.
Hopefully you had a good time in St. Paul last night. Made it.
Yeah. Thank you.
So thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedules to drive all the way down here and testify. We really do appreciate that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Karen Kingsley. I'm the Policy Director at Ready for K, and I'll be really short. I just want to echo the widespread support for the recommendations from the Office of Early Learning Task Force. Most of you may have heard about Ready for K. We're a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to making sure that all of our children arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed, and we've been working on that and are very pleased to see some progress in this area. I had the opportunity to serve as a resource staff to the Office of Early Learning Task Force and had come from that from serving on the Access and Finance Committee of the Governor's Early Childhood Advisory Council, who had been looking on this. So we've been thinking and working on this idea of an Office of Early Learning for some time. The fact that we need someone in charge, as Karen Cadigan said, is really a top priority for Ready for K and has been for some time. It's also one of the five recommendations included in the Minnesota's Future Early Childhood Agenda, which was an agenda developed by an alliance of early childhood organizations, and it's now been endorsed by 65 organizations statewide. And at some point, you either will have or will get a little handout about that. But one of the things that I really want to say is that there are a number of people across the state that are very supportive of this idea, who've been behind this idea and want to make sure it moves forward, and really see it as a way of shifting the focus from thinking about specific programs and funding streams to really reorient the state departments to be thinking about the outcomes that parents and communities and the state want for children and their families. And we see that shift in perspective towards the outcomes being a really significant part of this emphasis. And we know that once we do this coordination, as you've heard in Invest Early, but also at the state level, we can streamline services, we can reduce inefficiencies, we can really maximize the very limited state and federal resources that we have, and really make progress towards tracking and achieving better outcomes. We really see this as a way that we can support our youngest citizens, that we can make the state more efficient and more effective, more supportive of what's happening in local communities, and something that can really move us forward in a way that, that really gets us going towards those outcomes and the goal that you all have set of all children school ready by 2020. So with that, I'll end and just say thank you for your time and for all that you do to think about our youngest Minnesotans. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I think that completes our testifiers. Is that correct? So, members, we have about 5 minutes for questions here, and I guess I don't know how we're going to determine who's going to answer the questions, so maybe if you're all just kind of on call and ready to go. I guess I have a question for anyone who's willing to answer it before we'll start with Representative Reiner after my question. But and that is, in the governor's budget recommendations, he proposes a partial phase-in of all-day kindergarten in fiscal year 14 at a cost of roughly $33 million. And obviously, we want to, you know, in a perfect world, we would have piles of money laying around so we could put all this money into all-day kindergarten and we could put more money into early childhood. In a perfect world, we wish we could do that. But we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world of limited resources. And the data I've read has suggested that if you have a small amount of money to spend, that early childhood is a better place to spend it than all-day kindergarten. And I understand that's a difficult choice, but that's my understanding of the data, and I'm wondering if you have any, or if any one of the testifiers has any thoughts on that.
You couldn't have started out with an easier question, I guess, Mr. Chair.
I actually thought that was a pretty difficult question. Yes. So, but
no, that's what I meant. Sorry, with an easy question.
Oh, okay.
That is a really hard question. I think so. A couple of things. One is that certainly for making policy decisions, using research, should be one component, but not the only component. One of the things we know about full day everyday kindergarten is that parents really want it. And so that certainly is a variable. In terms of the research, though, not only on child outcomes, but on sort of the ecological benefit, the ecological economic benefit, child care or other kinds of early childhood programs are, I hesitate to say a better use of money, but you could see more impact. And the reason is a couple-fold. One is that children who receive quality, and again, this would all refer to quality, early experiences, have better outcomes on academic and social measures than children who have just received full-day everyday kindergarten. The other thing that happens with childcare and preschool experiences is that as we increase the quality and access to quality, we increase people's capacity in the workforce in two ways. One is allowing parents to work or to further their education, and the second is continuing to build this substantial workforce of early childhood professionals. I mean, in Minnesota alone, we have 28,000 child care providers. It's more than elementary school teachers. And so there are other sort of spillover effects of providing for child care. I don't know if anyone else wants to.
What's Itasca County think about that?
Let me tell you. I guess I would encourage you, as you're trying to make the choice there, to give some flexibility to communities to choose whether they invest those dollars at the kindergarten level or whether they invest those dollars in early childhood. If you open it up and allow communities to make that decision, they'll make the right choice for the children in their community. In Itasca County, our school districts have gone to all-day, everyday kindergarten, and we've had the conversation, should those dollars flow from the state and free up some of those general fund dollars, we could redirect those into early childhood. Or if we can use the all-day, everyday K, we keep the general fund dollars in place and then replace them. So allowing local communities to have some flexibility and looking at the needs within their community would be great.
And just from a statewide perspective, you have the benefit in your school district of having already offered all-day kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So the new money that would come in the form of paying for all-day kindergarten for those in the free and reduced lunch program will free up additional resources. Mm-hmm. There are other school districts which currently do not offer all-day kindergarten for all students. They have it on a fee-based program, but they don't pay for it. Mm-hmm. And they would be faced with a choice of, if they wanted to leverage the all-day kindergarten dollars, they would have... Because there's no additional money to provide for those non-free and reduced lunch students to have all-day kindergarten, they would have to cut other services to pay for that. And again, that's a difficult choice,
right.
And it's one of the many decisions that I think this committee will be struggling with in the coming weeks. Is that the best way to do it? If not, what is the appropriate way to do it? And so, just a thought there.
We would definitely say from the Invest Early project that your best, as Karen has said, your best economic return would be investing in early childhood. Your best future and outcomes for children, if they get more early, they will have those benefits that will be lifelong. And that's part of our third year longitudinal study with Wilder Research Center, is to actually demonstrate that.
And I think the chair's opinion is that the data supports that. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. We will... We have questions. Representative Breinert and Downey, if you could just be very brief, since everyone was on time and used their time appropriately, and then I sucked it all up at the end, so I'm sorry. Representative Breinert. Well,
so, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment to your question. I would say it's a really powerful question, but it might be more fairly addressed with a more diverse group at the table. Here you have early childhood people that are obviously going to speak to one side of that answer. So,
Representative Breinert, that is an astute observation.
All right.
Yes. Representative Breinert, and my wife, who is a kindergarten teacher, I can assure you, is lobbying the other side of it every night when my head hits the pillow. So,
very good, Mr. Chair. So, a question for Dr. Cadogan. You had mentioned that the statewide data in terms of kindergarten readiness has remained relatively the same over the last 8 years. Do you have any breakdown of that data regionally or county or school district-wise? Because I know in my own school district, we have seen some change in that data. And so I'm wondering what that breakdown might be and what variables you see in the breakout of that data.
That's a great question. It's always good to think about what data actually says. The State Department of Education would have the details of that. I don't have them off the top of my head. My understanding is that in terms of how we judge whether children are ready for school in Minnesota is really by a sample. It's not by looking at data all across the state. So certainly, you know, there would be numbers that average out. So things may be better in some districts versus others.
Representative Brenner?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll speak to someone at the department about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Downey, you get the last question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple of comments, but I'll dispense with those and just ask if you if you went a little further than some of the kind of statements of intent research, did you actually get down to modeling what this new agency would look like? I know the fiscal notes from last year that I just reviewed pointed out the number of people that would be brought over, and we'd add a couple of director-level people, but then there were big open questions about what a new state agency requires in terms of back-office administrative staff, IT staff. You've got these very complex DHS and MDE systems that would somehow have to now have a new IT infrastructure to coordinate with them. It seems to me that at a time like this, when we've got a huge challenge of prioritization in the first place, that we would be wise to, as best we can, direct our funding towards the programs and the people and not the back office. So did you model any of that? Did you kind of do a, gee, this is what this thing looks like, and here's how much this administrative agency costs over a 5 or 10-year period? How deep did you go?
Yeah, that, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, that's a great question. We did certainly talk about the money to do this kind of thing quite a lot. And I would say a couple of things. One is that, so last year, this MOVE study was commissioned, and I'm not sure if that's in your packet or not. But that includes quite a lot of detail about the sorts of backroom supports that you are referring to. And some of the programs it would be moving have administrative dollars attached to them, so that would account for part of it. While the agency staff on the task force felt very strongly that physical co-location was ideal, you know, the final recommendation is not necessarily for physical co-location. It's for something that's more potentially like a management structure. In terms of the modeling, we didn't get into the details of, you know, how much money could be saved over the long term, but that sort of was certainly the hypothesis of doing that. And I'm happy to provide the MOVE study with y'all. I feel like there's another part of your question that I didn't answer.
Yes, why you keep saying y'all.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I lived in Virginia for a while. The state, not the town.
Yeah, teasing all day, teasing all day. And Representative Kiffmeyer, if you want to begin to make your way down to the table, Representative Kelly has exercised his prerogative as the vice chair and would like to ask one final question. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey hit on it. I have a question just about creating this bureaucracy, too, because in the report it just says, due in part to this lack of singular leadership, the state has not seen any significant increase in the number of school-ready children since the Minnesota School Readiness Study began in 2002. And that seems to be astounding to me, that we believe that creating a new agency and a new bureaucracy is going to correct all that. With everything we heard here, all the wonderful things that are going on in all these different programs, it seems to me that we need to direct the resources to where you're getting results. So,
Representative Kelly, Chair Garofalo, that is one of the concerns that was echoed over and over again in the public and by task force members, that the idea is not to add more layers or add more bureaucracy, but rather to streamline things and to focus money and other kinds of resources in a way that outcomes can be measured. So as I said at the very beginning of my presentation, that one of the important things to take away from the idea of an office is that it is not four walls and a door, that it is a way of doing business, and that it's not necessarily adding new. None of this was that. I think there's one new staff person, and that would be a director, but the rest of it is not adding any new staff or any new program dollars.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you again to all our testifiers who took time out of their schedules to come here and speak with us about the report and offer their perspective. We greatly appreciate it. And Representative Kiffmeyer, before we take your bill up, I just wanted to thank members of the committee for attending the field trip yesterday. Something that we got when we were leaving was a packet of letters from the students at the Concordia Creative Learning Academy, and I just wanted to pick out some of my favorite comments from some of these. Becky writes that how happy she was that she came to our school and that she was doing the dividing two-digit divisions and having fun. And then Elijah wrote here that he's one of the fast math people. And I know who fast math people are, so I think Elijah's going to do well. Thomas wrote here that he would not give up even when he's tired, when he's learning. And then another kid here, Brian, says that one kid's head even hurt because there was so much learning going on. So, and then this was from Terrell. What did Terrell say that I liked? The teachers are so nice, and they have been working their butts off for us. So I just really appreciate, you know, I know members, we sometimes, you know, our job, one of our jobs as legislators is to fix things that are broken. So by the very nature of what we do, we tend to focus on those things that need correction and need changes. But it is important for all of us to understand that there are pockets of inspiration out there. There are islands of success out there that are getting some great things done. And I hope that the members who were able to attend visit those sites yesterday had an opportunity to see some of those people. And there are people, we sit up here and we talk about doing things. You know, that's what we do. And these are the people who are actually on the front lines that are actually doing it. And I hope that it was a rewarding experience for members of the committee. And certainly not right now, but at some point in the future, I'd like some feedback over whether that's something that members of the committee would like to continue to do. And perhaps in the fall, if we were to visit maybe places that are a little bit farther away from the Capitol, a little bit smaller school districts to get some just a geographic diversity of the state. And again, thank you to those members who attended. Representative Kiffmeyer, the chair, will move House File 355 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And my understanding is that you have an amendment.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
All right, the chair will move the A3 amendment. Representative Kiffmeyer, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment reduces the number 15 down to 10 so that it affects the fiscal note, and this was in response to the previous committee and some of the issues brought forward that we met with them and adjusted some of those numbers to make sure we didn't inadvertently include non-public schools that we did not want them to be. And so work together with that, and so that number in particular is reduced 15 to 10. We also inserted non-public school, those languages as well, and then also clarifying the must report by October 1. So all of it together is agreed upon language that is a response to the last committee hearing, and also the new fiscal note reflects the amendment as well, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. And members, do we have the, Ms. Johnson, or Mr. Stroll, Mr. Fromm, do we have the revised fiscal notes in our packets? Or? Yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Crow.
Members, it should be labeled H9998, I think, at the top.
Okay, I'm sorry.
On the bill number.
It was right in front of me. So. Any discussion to get the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have any additional amendments?
No, Mr. Chairman. That is the sum total of the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, to your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is a homeschool lifting mandates reduction, but not just for homeschools. A good thing here is that it's also lifting mandates in regards to the superintendents. And I met with a couple of my local superintendents, and they are very grateful for this bill because they would like these mandates lifted as well. Now, it's important to remember that we have history here of about 20 years or so of these mandates as they are currently written. And I understand that 20 years ago they may have had some concerns, but this is a high mandate state to homeschoolers, high mandate state. There are other states much lighter. What this would do is move us into the medium level of oversight. But I think after 20 years they have proven their mettle, you might say, in regards to the statistics and the results that we have here, that they have proven that. The fiscal part of this right now is savings in regards to, in fiscal year 12, $499,000, in 13, $573,000. This comes from three particular areas of the bill. One is counseling. The other one is textbook support, the $80 a year. And then the third one, Mr. Chairman, I happen not to have a copy of the full bill. I grabbed everything in my hand that I could, but if the page could.
If we could just have a page bring Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate
honorary
that.
Page member Kathy Reinhart.
Appreciate
Mr.
that
Press.
Very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Brennan, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And so these are the three areas that are affected by the fiscal note. Mr. Chair, I know that you are a finance committee and you can read. Really appreciate that. And just a comment in regards in general, so I want to make it as brief as I can and instead respond to any questions there might be. And also I have a testifier with me today as well who has some prepared remarks, so I would rather defer and yield more comments from me to instead have a testifier who's taken his time to be here today. That would be okay.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Watkins. I'm a homeschooling father since 1986. I've been around a long time. I have 8 children, 12 grandchildren, one on the way as well. But I'm also the chairman of the board of directors for Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators, or MASHE, as many would know. We're the largest homeschooling group in the state, representing about 3,000 member families. One of the things that we do is to put on one of the largest homeschool conferences in the nation here in this region. This year will be up in Duluth in the mid-April. But MASHE is here to strongly support Representative Kiffmeyer's bill and in our effort to reduce homeschooling mandates. About 2 years ago, the superintendents and school boards really put the idea together, and homeschoolers came on board trying to see how we could perhaps compromise and work a situation out to reduce mandates that would help both homeschoolers and the district superintendents. The goal was to again reflect the cooperative nature between the school districts and homeschooling families. When we began homeschooling many years ago, there was some animosity between homeschoolers and the school district because there was not an understanding of really what homeschoolers were doing. And as Representative Kiffmeyer has already said, I think we have proved over the last 20, 25 years that we turn out a good product, a solid product, and the superintendents are seeing that as well and realize, too, the unnecessary paperwork that is really a problem with the superintendents as well as an issue for homeschoolers. We believe Representative Kiffmeyer's bill has successfully captured this particular goal of the legislation. I know this is not a policy issue committee, so I won't really want to address that. But we do feel like it's a step in the right direction for reducing the paperwork for both the school districts and then homeschooling families. The reason, of course, that the bill is before this particular committee is because of the cost savings to the state of Minnesota by exempting homeschoolers from participating in the non-public pupil aid program. We realize it's a somewhat controversial issue, and we understand that, but we also know that it's a compromise with the superintendents and the school boards. As Representative Kiffmeyer has already indicated, about $1.1 million savings for the state over the biennium. About one-fourth of the homeschool families in the state apply for this particular textbook aid at somewhere between $80 and $85 per year. In order to get the aid, homeschool families need to apply through the local school district, and so there's a lot of paperwork and we feel like non-essential areas that are causing difficulties with both groups. And because of the nature of homeschooling, these requests become difficult for the public schools to administer. They have to look not only at the request for funds, but they have to look at the materials presented, if it meets the criteria that the state has mandated, and so on. So as a result, this is one of the major elements of the bill that we feel like is certainly addressed. We do understand that this could be a sacrifice for some homeschool families, but the general feeling, certainly from the families that MASHE represents, again, about half at least of the homeschool population at least is a member of our group or certainly attends our conference. Usually the conference ranges anywhere from 4,500 attendees to 6,200, depending on where in the state that we hold it that particular year. And we know that most of our families, we did a survey, that we had a very good representation of those families responded and indicated that about 80 to 85% of them are completely in favor of this issue of giving up the textbook aid, and certainly because it would reduce the mandate for homeschoolers as well. So our issue is, even though the textbook aid program was put into place to perhaps willingly help homeschoolers, we think that they have enough entrepreneurship and creativity that it's really not going to be that big a problem for most families. So we would encourage the support of House 355 and encourage the committee to pass that on. We appreciate the time to share our thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have any other testifiers you wish to have present?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have any other testifiers, but I believe there are a couple others that would like to testify, and I'll...
Okay, this is a public hearing, members, so we're going to take public testimony before we move on to questions. Is there any, those in the audience wish to testify either for or against House File 355? Pam Van Goren, did I say? Pam? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And you should know the chair's favorite color is purple. So, good job.
Well, then I got the right message. Good afternoon. My name is Carla Andrus, and I'm a home educator.
Oh, one moment. I'm sorry. My understanding was that Pam Van Goren was the first person to testify. No, but you're saying this...
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to give you both a chance here. Someone had signed up in advance, and I want to make sure they're usually given preference before we call people out of the audience. So, is Pam here?
I'm here.
Okay, so you want to let her go first. Okay, thank you. The chair is just a couple
She told me to go ahead.
I understand. Now, please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Carla Andrus, okay, and I'm a home educator in St. Francis. I have six children, and presently I'm home educating three children. I'm unhappy with provision in House File 355 that eliminates the non-public pupil aid. We are a low-income family. That aid is important to the quality of education that I can provide to my children. It's also important to other Minnesotans. Since almost 5,900 parents applied for that aid last year, approximately 17,000 actually received it. This is a significant number who need the aid. This makes a huge difference in my household. We have a special needs child. It provides for them so that they don't have to have boring textbooks and they can have interesting alternative curriculum. Special needs students often need different ways to learn other than textbooks and desk work. We can purchase cost prohibited materials like GeoSafari, interactive globes and puzzles to make their learning more interesting, and it does amazing things for them. If I don't have to spend dollars on educational supplies, then we can use it for our groceries. We truly are that strapped for money. I do raise a large garden, and I'm frugal. The per pupil aid is a significant amount of money for my family, and I can see how many people do not understand that the small amount of aid of $80 per pupil may not seem like a lot, but to my family, it is. I know I'm not the only person out there that struggles in this economy, and in fact, since last time I testified a couple weeks ago, gas has gone up 40 cents. I was dropped off here by somebody that was going to St. Paul so that I could come here and testify. And even the parking can be an issue for some people. In fact, I also have another friend who is closely related with MSHE and Homeschool Legal Defense Association that didn't even know about this bill. And she was not happy with losing the money for this non-public pupil aid. May not have a strong support network so that this information can get out and that they can come here to testify. I think it's important for people to find out, and I hope that you reconsider this part of the provision in the House Bill 355. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You said, how many children do you homeschool right now?
Six.
You have six children that you homeschool?
Yeah. Well, presently it's three of them I'm homeschooling.
Okay, so you're homeschooling.
I've had some that have graduated.
Well, good, good. Are they doing well now in post-secondary, or are they post-secondary environment they work in?
I have four children that have special needs.
Okay.
They're not going to be going on to college and things like that.
Okay.
And so we work a lot with daily living skills and being able to make it in the real world.
Well, thank you very much, and I think it's an important point for members of the committee to understand is that when people like you choose to homeschool your children, you are actually not only providing a valuable service, you are saving citizens of Minnesota quite a bit of money with all those homeschool.
Yeah.
I mean, because if everyone who homeschooled just popped into the public schools today, there would be significant additional costs to both the state of Minnesota as well as local property taxpayers. So you're, in some respects, you're paying twice.
And I was told by the school when I had one of my children evaluated, and he has an IEP, not to put them in because they could not do the maladaptive things that I have done with wipe-off boards, the exercise balls, the giant Biggins balls to sit on so that he could sit there and do his schoolwork. I've torn apart rocking chairs just to get the giant spinny thing for them so that they could do their spelling. They sit on it and they spin and do their spelling. You can't do that in a public school.
Sure.
And it has made a difference.
And different children learn in different ways in different situations. Well, thank you very much for your testimony today. Ms. Van Goren, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Pam Van Goren. I live in Minnetonka, and I am a longtime home educator. My husband and I first began teaching our children at home in 1977. We now have grandchildren who are being home educated. In my letter to you and to others, I indicated that in the reporting mandate reduction part of this bill, this reflects good thinking for the 21st century. I was monitored the task force that wrote the current definition of school bill. That reflected the thinking of mid-1980s, and it's time to bring it into the 21st century. Yes, homeschoolers have proved their way. My concern with the bill is the extension of the disenfranchised, shall we say, of the for this bill into non-public group schools, whether it's 15 or fewer or 10 or fewer or 1 or fewer. There are a significant number of them. You have a fiscal report from the Senate when it was heard there. Nevertheless, even dropping it down to 10 or fewer, you are going to hit the Adventist Christian School in Becker County, Detroit Lakes. You are going to get a Lutheran school in Rosemont. You are going to get another Lutheran school in Woodbury. I'm not going to go down through this whole list. This is just patently unfair. I'm speaking to you as a citizen. If Mache wishes to encourage their members not to use this fund, it's an opt-in program. They don't have to use it. Money not used returns to the general fund. But to write this bill in such a way that it covers the other half of the homeschooling community who are not part of this organization, and they are not going to know about this until September when they file their report and expect to have this money and have made their budgets, it's not going to be nice. It's not going to be pretty, I fear. And then to do this to legitimate, non-public, very small schools who are not even home educators is really unfair, particularly since the bill, the statute, is a couple of units up from where the part of the law that you're preparing to modify here. This is the declaration of policy for that, 120B.40, enacted in 1975, modified a couple of times since to change it from child to student to pupil, but it still has stayed the same language. It is the intent of the legislature to provide for distribution of educational aids, such as textbooks, standardized tests, pupil support services, so that every pupil in the state will share equitably in education benefits and therefore assure all Minnesota pupils and their parents freedom of choice in education. I spent a bit of time in a law library earlier this week when this was I found out it was going to be heard today, and discovered that, and I'm not a lawyer, I don't have any legal background, but I read U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and this law appears to have been written following three. The language that we have here reflects the language that occurred when legislation in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York was handed down. And phrase by phrase, our law matches what was approved by the Supreme Court or rendered constitutional. I have considerable concern that if you take out one class of children, you're going to register, make this particular piece of this bill unconstitutional, since it says every student. That was a point in Wolman versus Walter, I believe. So that is my concern. Furthermore, in our current law, we have another statute, 123B.445, which is the provision for Minnesota Non-Public Education Council, which has as one of its specific duties the aspect of resolving complaints about services with this non-public pupil aid. If there are problems with it, a parent or a school may come to the council. They will hear it, discuss it, and advise the commissioner. So I am puzzled that this has even come to the legislature. I would suggest that you pass the first half of this and not pass the second half and send it on to the non-public ed council where it belongs. And so that is my testimony.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. And again, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'll make sure to give you an opportunity to respond and offer your thoughts as soon as we conclude with public testimony. We'll also make sure we fit in members' questions. The final testifier, is this a public hearing? And Mr. is it Heller?
Heller.
Mr. Heller wishes to testify? Do you have a handout for the committee, Mr. Heller?
I'm not sure. I heard that you got to get permission before you hand them out. I've been handed them out already. Too many of these people that sit on reform, so be it by your permission, I'd have something.
If we just get one copy of it, the chair will take a look at it, and then we'll make that decision. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak here today regarding this bill. 355. I've been up here representing the unrepresented, as you all know. It's students that have are print disabled and students that are twice exceptional, which is a gift and a disability. I testify today because the handouts I've been handing out from the National Center of Learning Disabilities, which talks about accessing instructional materials. I agree with the last testifier that you will be opening a can of worms regarding the removing the accessibility issue, because the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 strictly prohibit the these materials not to be made accessible for free. It may impact, again, the liability regarding the other parties that are not involved in this that may have a print disability. I believe those who are print disabled have free access to your materials that you share in the school. So once again, That's about all I have to say about it. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to members' questions. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Come on down. This is not The Price is Right, but come on down anyways. And please state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nicholas Vandenberg.
And how do you say that again, last name?
Vandenberg.
Vandenberg, okay.
I was home educated from second grade through the end of high school. My family used Per-Pupil Aid to purchase other materials, textbooks, and my sibling still does today, for she's 11, my 11-year-old sister. There are probably many people that do not know this bill will get rid of Per-Pupil Aid for home-educated students. My mom and I checked the Home School Legal Defense Association website to renew House File 355. I have pasted the information on my sheet here. There is nothing about Per-Pupil Aid disappearing from this bill. I'm concerned that many people do not know they will lose this aid for their families. We live in difficult economic times. This small amount of aid makes a big difference for families. My family home educated 7 children, and the aid meant approximately an extra $450 per year for my parents to spend on books and other materials. My mom bought me Rolled Thunder, Hear My Cry for me. I had my own copy of the book rather than just going to the library. I was able to read and reread the book because of Per-Pupil Aid. I could write in the book and make notes. We had a study guide with the book. Sometimes buying books for all of us limited the number of materials we can own. We still use the library a lot. I learned from my mom teaching me I could pick classes and make other things if I didn't like the classes. I think it's important not to get rid of Per-Pupil Aid, and thank you for your time, and I'd rather consider the cut.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and my apologies. I looked to the right, and I looked to the left, and pulled away from you, and we appreciate That's you coming right. in, taking the time for public testimony. I'll let you in a little secret. When the members of the public come and testify to the legislature, we listen and pay a lot more attention than when the people who get paid here talk. So
All right.
we, which I suppose my friends in the lobbying community don't like to hear, but oh well. So thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Representative Kiffmeyer, I want to give you an opportunity to respond before we take members' questions, or do you prefer to take questions from the members of the committee first?
Mr. Chairman, I will go ahead and take questions if that's okay, because I think the members' questions are more important than even my comments.
Okay. Any members of the committee who wish to ask any questions? Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer. I applied for this non-public pupil aid for about 14 years as I home educated my children through the years. And for most of that time, it was anywhere between I never got $85. I think the top was probably about $70 back a couple years ago. I understand it is a huge effort because parents receive a letter from the school district, and then we gather our receipts for that $80 or $70 refund. We send in those receipts, and then someone at the school district has to go through those and identify if each individual item is acceptable or not. And then I would sometimes get a letter back and saying this piece of software is okay, but this other one is not. And I would speak in favor of this amendment, this House file, because it is a lot of effort on the part of the superintendents. It is a lot of effort on the part of homeschoolers, and I think they really would like a reduction in the mandates, and they see that, yes, they would be giving up this small portion of funds, but they really would like to see the relief. So thank you for bringing this forward. And just to reaffirm, it's like $80 for the year.
It is $84, right? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, go ahead. Call
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. The amount for this particular year is $84.66.
Mr. Chair, Myra? Representative Kiffmeyer, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Reinhart, and then left-handed. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, you may be intending to answer this, but I'm very concerned about the issue that was raised by one of the testifiers on the constitutionality issue, which is, and I've just pulled this statute 123B.40, and it does say so that every school pupil in the state will share equitably. So and this may be something you haven't thought up to this point. I'm not trying to put you on the spot in any manner, but I would think you would want to consider that policy statement in relation to eliminating that benefit.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Reinhart. Absolutely. I think all these last 20 years, I mean, I'm a homeschool mom, 11 years, and my kids are graduated, and I have grandkids being home educated. So absolutely, we've always felt all along that in many ways, we as home educators have saved the state a lot of money and have not had some of that full equity, you might say. But we felt that our freedom and our opportunity to be with our children and put them in the center of our lives in a very, very full way, yes, we gave up some of that. And it hurts me now in regards to bringing a compromise bill that, again, that little bit, but that came with so much paperwork and a whole bunch of mandates. It's a compromise. And so it's unpleasant, and I would agree with you, and I would be thrilled to be able to forego that part of my bill and enable us to just have that policy side of it. But it was a compromise. But it's possible that that may be one of those issues. And I would say I really respect the testifier in bringing that matter forward and some of that. And I don't know necessarily that we've included all of that in, because on the policy side we're fine. It just, I hadn't thought about it on more heavily. And there may be other comments in regard to that, but I appreciate your bringing it up.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm hopeful that you will look further into this, because I have a great deal of empathy for the motives of homeschooling parents. I almost homeschooled my kids from in elementary, and I did homeschool one daughter in high school, and so it's not that's not the issue for me at all, but it's more understanding that there are parents who may not have had any say in this decision. So you, wherever the compromise was made, who's being excluded from the process, and are we violating our own intent here in the statute?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Reinhart. You know, there was no intent to exclude anybody, but as you all know, sometimes when you introduce a bill, it is that then folks are able to read it, comment on it. We've all had that happen. And so I think the real value is only when you bring the matters forward do you have the ability to have more substance in regards to having that input, and that is certainly what the process is for. Did you have anything else on
Representative
that
Briner? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to hopefully briefly reiterate my concerns about this bill that I already shared with the policy committee, but since everyone in on this committee isn't on that committee, I'll just repeat them. And I always think it's that we should try for financial equity and opportunity, so the testifiers have my ear, and that is a concern. However, the main reason I oppose this bill is the elimination of the responsibility of the superintendent of schools to monitor compulsory attendance, which is being deleted in this bill. Representative Mariani has left, but we had this discussion in policy committee when he was here. He has a bill where he's actually trying to increase the compulsory attendance for two more years for high schoolers, and made the statement in policy committee that, unfortunately, as it is, to have to say, there are some bad parents in the world, and that's why we have compulsory attendance, assuming that the students are not of the age of majority, and especially young students, sometimes as parents, that don't see to it that they get to school. I did have a chance between the policy committee and this committee to talk with Mr. Kite, who represents the superintendents, and he said this bill came from the homeschoolers, not from the superintendents. They don't have a very strong law for the charge that they're given to monitor homeschoolers, so it's very hard for them to do anything, and maybe they aren't doing anything, but they weren't asking to not be responsible. This did come from the homeschoolers, and I always think that is hard when you have mandates, but I think mandates are there to protect children, and this is one I would not want to see go away, so I have to oppose this bill.
Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have a response?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Greiling, and I've heard those issues before. And the big thing is to separate this out. There are laws for bad parents, and bad parents come from homeschool, private school, public school. And so bad parenting is just bad parenting. However, statistically, amongst those who homeschool, statistically, they have a very high component, very active parenting. And we all know that the success in most any educational situation, a large component is active parenting and being actively engaged, and that is what home education, putting the student at the center, does accomplish that. But we have laws for those who have those issues and those reporting mechanisms. In regards to the initiating, yes, the initiating of the actual legislation, but it was the conversation of the superintendents, and they're mentioning in the process of their activities that these mandates in regards to what they did, and it was hearing their burdens and hearing their issues that said, okay, maybe we can have a conversation with them and see if we can have a compromise here. I would suspect that probably the dollar savings is their motivation, and some of the lifting of the mandates might be the homeschoolers that there is agreement among them more strongly. That's where the compromise comes from. But hearing their conversation was part of the initiation of the actual legislation.
And Representative Greiling, this is actually a question I don't know the answer to. but in that situation where they're verifying, I guess, attendance, outside of the parents reporting what their children are doing, is there any other activities that are going on? Do you know the answer to that or not?
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Kite said, this is a very weak law. And so whether they have the tools with the law that we have to actually do their job is a good question. However, I don't believe at all that the answer is then to say, okay, then we didn't give them a good tool, so now we're not going to ask them to do anything at all. In fact, former Republican Education Policy Chair Harry Mayers, who preceded Representative Carlson, and I worked for quite a while on strengthening this law at one time. I don't know exactly how many people around this table were here for Representative Mayers, but we actually met with school people more than once, like two or three times, the ones who were collecting this information for the superintendents, and they were a very frustrated lot. You know, they were the ones that collected the test scores and needed to try to enforce compulsory attendance and get data. And they were making the case that they couldn't do a good job with the laws that we have, so they asked for a stronger law that would have more teeth in it and more ways for them to do what you're asking on behalf of the students. You know, we should always remember we're here for the students, not the adults. And we were unable, even though we were obviously a bipartisan team and we had a lot of support, when we had the actual hearing on the bill, we were inundated with homeschool parents who didn't want that bill. And legislators folded, who even had previously been going to before it. I know it's hard to imagine. And then we didn't get the legislation. But if I had my druthers, that's the direction I think we should go, not saying we have given them a poor law, so now we should wipe it out. We should, in fact, if we were doing the right thing by kids, make sure it was strong enough to mean something. But I have a hunch we're not going to do that this year or next year, so then I would just ask that we keep what we have as a placeholder so that someday we could make it meaningful.
Thank you. And Representative Greiling, you bring up a good point there in the sense that one of the reasons I think people choose to homeschool is for that flexibility, the ability to innovate, to do what they want. And I think that there's a massive generalization to make of every homeschool parent, but one of the concerns they would have is that more state involvement, more department involvement, and there's a balance there, and the question is what is the balance? So thank you for that perspective and for giving us some legislative history on it as well. Representative Downey. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, to take Representative Greiling's concerns about compulsory attendance one step further, I notice in Section 9, you now will allow the parent, the homeschool parent, to issue an employment certificate so that a homeschool student can work on school days. Something feels not quite right there. On the one hand, we're weakening accountability over the money. Then we're weakening accountability over attendance. And then we appear to be sending our 14 and 15-year-old children out to the logging camp to work instead of following some modicum of attendance requirements. Could you make me feel a little bit better about that?
Representative Kiffmeyer, before you answer that question, I'm wondering if we could have Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom just explain to us how the current section of law, how that currently works for those minors who are seeking certificates of employment. Or maybe not. Maybe not. Okay.
I don't know what a certificate
is. Representative Kiffmeyer to Representative Anzell's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Andel. Yes, absolutely. You have to remember, we're homeschooling. They live in school. When you home educate, your student lives in the school. And the flexibility that sometimes they can take a job during the day and homeschool in the evening when dad is around to teach physics is a pretty good advantage. But it's kind of an interesting thing of the concept that when you think of school, you think of just day. But when you home educate, your classroom is the home, and they're with you, and being able to have that kind of flexibility so that when the public school students get out and they can have those evening jobs or do some of those things, and some of them do also work during the day. But, you know, when you're living in school, pretty hard to play hooky.
Representative Anzels, did you have a follow-up? And I guess I had asked staff, and want to maybe have staff get clarification of this. My understanding was that under current law, the sort of certificate of employment, that there is a broad latitude of who can sign off on that right now. It's not just limited to executive personnel of school districts, but that there's very broad latitude in who's allowed to sign off. I could be mistaken, but maybe that would be something we can have staff look into and share that information with the committee. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you are correct. And not only that, it's a lot of paperwork for the superintendents and their staff as well. And I think, again, they've earned some credibility in that regard. So this is one of those things that expedites that process and gives that flexibility and reduces them. That's one of those mandates, paperwork.
Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to note that in some instances, I had to refer some of my children or parents to the county attorney in cases where, for example, a constituent called to complain that perhaps the children weren't actually being homeschooled. And so my recourse then, if the superintendent didn't respond, was to go to the county attorney, and you were asking if there was another way. And
sure.
That's just an example of what
Thank
happened.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any other questions from members of the committee? With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 355 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I would just take the liberty, if I could, to just have a closing.
You may, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Since you promised to me, Mr. Chairman,
you may.
I kind of had to save that. And it isn't so much in regards to the issues here that we're dealing with in regards to the finance, but it's also in particular that this is not a bill that is reduced, taking away all the mandates. We're going from a high mandate state to a medium. And also, I think returning back to the situations of parents being put in jail for exercising their right in regards to putting their students first, their own children's students first, I think is really important. So it's a compromise bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for your opportunity to the hearing. Thank you for all the testifiers and the points that they have brought up.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer, and other testifiers. Members of the committee, just one quick announcement. As members know, we have extremely aggressive deadlines for the committee schedule this year, the finance deadline. This bill has to be in the possession of the Ways and Means Committee March 25th. So members should plan on a very aggressive schedule next week, additional committee hearings at night, and even the possibility of Friday and perhaps even Saturday. So we want to make sure members are aware of that. Are there any questions or comments? Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you'll do some things to coordinate with other committees that are also meeting on very aggressive schedules. So
yes, Representative Reinhardt, as has been customary in the past, is that it is very common that members will have two committees meeting at the same time. Nothing new to this process, just that it's happening in March, and it's finance versus policy. Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, what kind of a notice will you give us, those of us from outstate Minnesota, greater Minnesota, rural Minnesota, you know, so that we can make sure that, like, for example, there's several other conventions and committees going on next weekend for us as well. So if we need to cancel those, what kind of a notice are we going to get, notification?
Representative Ward, we will provide it as soon as we possibly can. My understanding is under the current rules of the House, we have to notify at least 72 hours in advance. Is that correct? So, but Representative Ward, I don't want to wait until Wednesday to tell you about something on Saturday. We're going to try to get that sorted out tonight and tomorrow so you have the weekend to plan. But I understand that, as has been very customary in this institution, the situation is fluid, and we're going to try to do the committee's work as much as we can during normal time.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you.